Good evening, James McKinney with my Science Hour, July 22nd, 2021. Wow, halfway through the year and moving. This year, I'll say something. Last year at this time, I was going, holy cow, this year is going really fast and it's really nuts. I believe there's a bit of sanity coming back to things, and I'll just give you my perception. I watched some of the British Open. As I always say, I'm a better watcher of golf than a golfer. But nobody had masks. There was no social distancing. Everybody was in a very carefree mood. I didn't see anything related to boogeyman fear, everybody has to wear a mask. I did not see in all of the crowds, I did not see a single mask. Now this, mind you, is in England. This is the oldest golf tournament in the world. Originally, somebody told me in 1860 or 1880, I don't know, something like that. And anyway, I didn't see any sign of boogeyman fear, COVID, everybody's going to die syndrome. So I think people are just kind of shedding this and, ooh, the new Delta variation. I think people have it's the old cry wolf. You can cry wolf so many times and people are walking around and they're not dropping dead on the golf course from having COVID or being around other people. So anyway, that's a positive sign. The people in Paris were marching in the streets saying, no, we're not going to do the COVID passport thing, and the world leaders are losing power. So some of this stuff can backfire on them. But anyway, I see, I just advise people, just go about your life, get away from all of the goofy stuff, the schools where you have predators who have now infiltrated the schools. It's like the bank robbers. They ask the bank robber, how come you rob banks? And he says, that's because that's where the money is. So if you're a pervert, a pedophile, or some weirdo with some fetish for children, where do you go? You go get into school. You go get in the school system because that's where the kids are. And I'm sorry, sometimes I laugh, but that's a sarcastic laugh. I hope you understand that. But anyway, just get yourself out of all of that stuff. If you're going to control something in the government, just do it at the local level, county level, maybe max. If you have a good governor, then support that governor. If you have a bad governor, just write him a letter and say, hey, you don't count, buddy. We're not doing anything you say. Just you can play governor if you want, but whatever. So anyway, that's a positive note. So I would say compared to last year, this time we're doing a lot better, and the public is doing a lot better. And I would contrary to what they're saying, I would say maybe 10% of the population in the U.S. has gotten vaccinated, gotten the old arm jab thing. And probably about 90% are just like, no, I don't want nothing to do with it. I'll wait, and et cetera. But, okay, so enough of that. I'm not going to dwell on that other than a positive note. And I see people like, say, Richard Branson, who's going into space. He's following his dreams. He's not worrying about the boogeyman at his gathering where they went into space a week and a half ago. All the people were there hugging each other, various people that came in from around the world to see the historic flight and stuff. There was nobody, there was no fear of the boogeyman or anything like that. So people are moving ahead with their lives, and that's what I suggest. Get your direction, find out what you want to do what you want to do, and move ahead. Put those blinders on to the news media, turn the TV off, and, move ahead. Okay, I'm going to talk about archaeology, and a great topic here for tonight. Okay, a little bit of history here before I introduce this archaeological topic. But one area of archaeology is basically ocean archaeology, or what is under the ocean that's ancient and man-made, basically. But this find was recently announced anyway. And what happened, this is about 200 to 400 BC is the time frame. It is Greek and Egypt, both of them who have fairly significant navies at this time. And this particular find was an Egyptian warship. Now, it had a sail, and it was fitted with spots for oarmen. So oars and moving by both oars and by sail. And so I imagine sails when the wind was blowing in the right direction and oars pretty much the rest of the time. The interesting thing was it fit the classic Egyptian war vessel with a flat bottom, which is interesting, as that means it could be beached. In other words, it had a low draft so it could maneuver, and also in the Nile. So these were used around the Nile. But one of the very interesting parts of this, that the reason this boat sank is because it was tied to a mooring. In the mooring, there was a massive earthquake, and this is before the major port of Alexandria was formed. And the port that at the time was called Thonis Heraclion, and basically a Greek name, but which shows you kind of the mixing of these technologically advanced civilizations. They had fairly advanced warships, etc. And if I'm not mistaken, this is the kind with the long prow where they would come into the side of another boat and hit it and then basically sink it, which made it difficult also if it was a shallow boat, a shallow draft boat. But the very interesting thing is that this boat was tied to a mooring, and the entire port city, Thonis Heraclion, went under in a single afternoon in an earthquake. And that's why this ship was on the bottom of the ocean. It basically got dragged down as it was tied to the mooring when this whole region sank into the ocean. Now, why is that significant? Because we have a similar story of Atlantis, which was many thousands of years BC, and basically suffering the same fate, where one day, whoosh, it just sank into the ocean. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because there are places in the world right now that have potential for the same issue. One is the Canary Islands. The Canary Islands are out in the Atlantic Ocean, and the Azores are out there. But the Canary Islands are famous for landslides that go take place underwater, and it's a geologically unstable area. But what happens when these regions slough, that's called sloughing, it's a geological term, when they slide, basically a big area. And now people think, well, you know, how could a big area just slide off? There's another place on the planet which is very similar. It's called Hawaii. And there are other places in the world that have these same issues. Now, what happens is on a volcanic region, the layers of volcanism build up. And it's called textbook term is AHA lava, which is the very slow-moving, rolling lava, like when Hawaii had its volcano eruption, 3 years ago now, about 3 years ago. The lava moved very slowly and basically overran a part of this eastern part of the big island near Oahu. I'm sorry, not Oahu, near Hilo, the county capital city on the eastern side of the island. And what happens is as the layers of lava build up, there's a disconnect between these layers. And what happens is when it rains hard, the water gets down and it gets in between these layers, which are hardened, but the interface between the layers becomes viscous, and it's almost like mud, like slippery mud. So the least little jiggle, and this is like a toboggan on skids, and you can have major sections of the island just slew out off into the ocean. This became apparent, probably about 10 years ago, maybe in that time frame, when geologists that were working at the, I believe they were at the University of Hawaii, were doing drilling offshore and looking at the sediment, the core samples that they were drilling for. And they realized that, hey, that land that used to be over there is now out in the middle of the ocean. And it had always been assumed that this, the erosion, the valleys that occurred there in these basically rifts areas, that these developed very slowly, eroded into the ocean over a long period of time due to rain, etc. And they realized that, no, these things went down in a flash, like in a couple minutes. And when you think about it, you have this tremendous amount of weight and then this viscous layer somewhere in the middle. And when something shakes a little bit, and of course in these areas it's volcanically active, it's tectonically active. In other words, the layers are recent. This can just slide off and you have this tremendous amount of weight in a very viscous surface between this layer, this massive amount of material, and the underlayer. And so once it starts to move, you're not going to stop it. Now, if you look on, let's go up to Mars, for example. Let's go up to Mars. And you can see that Olympus Mons, for example, now I have pictures of this on my webpage, on the Picture of the Day webpage, and you can access that by going to my radio show archives. And on every show link, I have a link there to the Picture of the Day subpage. Go there and scroll down, and I suggest you go through the whole thing. I haven't been able to update it recently. In fact, it's been a long time since I've updated this page. But there's so much good material there, and one of the things I really concentrate on is Mars. But you will see Olympus Mons with photos, and you see the slewing going on there. Now, the interesting thing is that slewing does not happen unless you have an ocean there. Because once it gets moving, then it enters the water and it keeps moving. If it were not for the ocean, this sliding of material would end very quickly. It would not go as far because these are found, these slewing composite regions of land, of basically volcanic material, are found miles offshore. And you can see this same effect on Olympus Mons. You can see the windward side, which is very much eroded, and then you see the leeward side, where it is like almost, well, that's where the beaches were, literally. And so you have the exact same situation, a volcanic island in the middle of an ocean, Olympus Mons, and the slewing that went on is proof that that slewing went on when there was an ocean there, because the slewed areas, regions, are way out away from Olympus Mons. So this is very interesting, and all of this relates back to this recent find of an Egyptian warship that sank off of the old harbor, which was gone. That's why they built Alexandria, the new big harbor that was around, I don't have a date, but within later than 200 BC was when Alexandria, the great port, was built and became a trading center for the entire world. So the port city of Thonis is called Thonis Heraclean, sank into the ocean around an estimated 200 BC. And they just found this city and then this boat, which is very interesting. And I've done a bit of boat building myself in my lifetime, designing boats, ocean-going sailboats primarily. So it's very interesting to see the timber work that went into the framing of this boat and then the planking, etc. And literally, they could reconstruct this boat from the materials that have been found there, and through modern reproduction techniques, reconstruct this particular war vessel. Now, this brings up another very interesting topic, because if you look at the The landscape right now around where this was found, there are no trees at all. And so one has to query, one has to imagine, where did this timber come from? And this is just one boat. They had fleets of these, hundreds, potentially thousands of these big boats. And they were manned with, they had a flat deck because in the Mediterranean, things were fairly calm. It wasn't like the Atlantic Ocean. And it was in and around a lot of these land regions. And so the boats were very large. So some of them were up to 1,000 feet long. So you have to ask yourself, where did the wood come from to build these ships? Large ships with hundreds of them, you know, being built all the time over a long period of time. And the answer is it came from where we now call this region the Sahara Desert. The Romans were also famous for building ships. They had the Romans and the Carthaginians, and they all had their naval fleets. And some of the most horrific battles took place out on the in the sea, in the Mediterranean. But where did all the wood come to build these? Because if you go to Italy today, you're not going to find any. If you go to Egypt or the old the region of Carthage or wherever these ancient civilizations existed, you will not find trees. And, of course, the type that you'd build a boat out of, especially a war vessel, is not just your average tree. These had to be hardwood, a lot of hardwood involved. And right now, for example, if you take a Viking longboat, some of these boats potentially 200 feet long, the majority were probably 80 to 100 feet long. The ocean-going big canoes, the Viking longboats, as they were called, which snaked through. They call them the dragon boats because as they went through the waves, the way they were built, they would slither. They would ride the waves, and the back end was going in, you know, twisted. They basically twisted as they were riding through the waves. Now I saw a reproduction. It was done, I think, up in northwestern Minnesota. There was a museum, and a guy rebuilt a Viking longboat, but he used lapstrake planking, which is what the Vikings were using. But he used, as I recall, bronze or copper rivets, where the planks were riveted together. So it was a very sturdy boat in the sense that the hull did not work like this, but in the days of the Vikings, what they did is they drilled a hole, actually two holes side by side through the planking where it met and overlapped. And if you understand how lapstrake planking works on a boat, the one plank overlaps the other one by a bit. And what they did is they drilled a hole using an auger, a hand auger. They drilled two holes close together, and they put a piece of like seal skin or leather through that hole, and then they tied it in a knot, and they took a piece of wood and they turned that to draw tension. But it wasn't 100% tension. And so the way they actually worked is those boards would slide along each other as the boat worked in the water. And with time, those planks sliding against each other made a perfect fit, a perfect watertight fit. And that's the way the old Viking boats were built. And that was very common in the days of ancient boat building. To build a boat like that, they also used wood nails in the big timber framing, the hull down in the keel, what is known as the keel and the bow and the stern, where those come together. They would use, actually the term is trunnels, and what it is a wooden peg with a slit in the end, in both ends actually, and what you would do is you'd put a wedge into that slit, and then at the base of the hole where this thing was supposed to go in, it would be solid wood. And so you drill a hole in, not completely through the wood, And then you'd have the second piece that was being attached with the hole that matched up, and you would drive this this trunnel down into the hole. And when it finally got to the point where the wedge was meeting the hard-resisting end of the hole, it started going into the wedging into the trunnel where the slit was, and would make it very tight. And of course, when the water started getting in there, it made it really tight. And the same way with the outside end, just as it was being driven home is the term, the boat building term, just as that trunnel was being driven home, meaning the final few wraps of the mallet, a big wooden mallet, the wedge would be put on that side, on the outside, and then driven in, and once again, create an extremely tight bond. And it's actually stronger than bolts. The difference is wood has the same strength as wood. So if you make your trunnels out of the same wood material as your framing material and the boat, or planking if it was used for planking, then the it would become like a single piece of wood. The whole thing became one and extremely strong, whereas bolts are actually stronger than the wood, so they can tear out. So at any rate, a little bit of boat building lore there. But very interesting that they found this ship in, you know, sunken, and as a recent discovery, the archaeology of things under the ocean. And by the way, there was an XPRIZE, one of the XPRIZE, when I was at the down in San Diego receiving my Technology Innovation Achievement Award XPRIZE for the 2018 XPRIZE event. There was a group there that they were doing underwater exploration as part of another XPRIZE. So it was fun talking to those people, because really about 0.001% of the ocean floor had really been discovered and explored up to this point, just very little. And so the idea was to have automated, just like they have automated searches of the heavens with big telescopes, the idea was to have automated searches of the ocean floor. And of course, you're going to find a lot of nothing down there, a lot of shells and a lot of just sand or whatever's on the bottom of the ocean. But in that process, if you scan the entire surface of the ocean, you would come up with some pretty interesting things, things that have been down there for hundreds, potentially thousands of years, potentially longer, things that are man-made or things, other structures, geological structures that people never knew were there. Okay, on to the next topic. Just a quick mention, the audit in Arizona is heating up. And it's very clear, and you can read what's going on by looking at the what you might call the opposition text press, the mainstream media, as they start throwing more and more mud at this recount. But the actual numbers are coming out that there were 74,000, more than 74,000 mail-in ballots that were never mailed. They were just there. Okay, in a state where 10,000 votes decided the president of the United States, and that was one of the key states, was Arizona, if you recall. Then you'll have Pennsylvania, Atlanta, Georgia, with, Macon County? I forget, it was Macon County, Macon. I think is the county where Atlanta, Georgia is. Once again, a lot of resistance. They don't want to let out the keys, the code words that allow you to get into the voting machines, all kinds of resistance, because there's, yeah, a lot of people are going to go to jail, you know, for fixing a presidential election. But in Arizona, another statistic, 174,000 votes that did not have anybody attached to them. And there was something like 11,000 other votes. I forget what the, I think they were related to either voter registration or the voting machines. And then there were hundreds of, let's see, there's a percentage here, 40% of the voting machines they have not allowed any access. And apparently Tucker Carlson did a story the other night dealing with, there was a break-in, some kind of a break-in that was in Atlanta, Georgia. And alarms went off. And so anyway, unbeknownst, when the police arrived, what they found were hundreds of thousands, something like 174,000 was, yeah. 174,000 mail-in votes that were being stored there. Nobody knew they were there. They were kind of like out of sight, out of mind. And so they started looking into this, and these are the ballots which were used to fix the election. Oh, another thing, another little fun fact here, back to Arizona, those 74,000 ballots that had no mailing associated with them, they were mail-in ballots but were never mailed out, because if they were mailed out, they would have the postal markings and somebody's name on them. But all of them went to Biden. Oh, isn't that choice? Isn't that interesting? That's certainly a fun fact. So anyway, Maricopa County, they've actually had senators, U.S. senators, call for a dissolution of the test result or of the election results, and to hold a new presidential election. And then, of course, the state comes back and says, "Oh, but you don't have authority to do that. There's nothing in the books." Well, wait a minute, boys and girls. If there's illegal activity going on in the election isn't legitimate, it should not have been certified, you call back the Electoral College people who went and made a decision for president on behalf of the people of the state, there's a lot of illegal activity here. But anyway, be that as it may, just wanted to give you an update. That's in the news if you look at the right news locations. It's not in the news if you're looking at the mainstream media. Switching topics now. A long, long time ago, when the fervor over greenhouse gases, greenhouse effect, global warming, global climate change, all of the above came into vogue, I said, hey, wait a minute. The thing we should really be talking about is that we're burning all this oil and using up the oxygen in the atmosphere. Well, finally, other people are picking up on this theme. And so there's measurements now of what the oxygen content was back in the 1800s before we started having major use of inert fuels, carbon-based fuels, which they are. They're carbon-based fuels. They did not come from dinosaur bones. They came from influx from outer space. But the issue was that, for example, if you calculated the amount of oil in the Orinoco region of Venezuela, which is the richest oil deposit in the world, if you look at that and you burned all of that. Now, I remember saying this on Alex Merklinger's show back in the early 2000s, maybe back in the late 1990s, and I was expressing that, you know, we're burning up all this atmosphere, and people go, oh, well, the Amazon jungle, you know, another ridiculous scientific bogus fact is that somehow the Amazon jungle would recycle the CO2 and provide us with oxygen, which is just absurd. Absurd. When you look at the NASA CO2 satellite images, the density of CO2 over the Amazon jungle is no more than any other place on the planet, or the lack thereof, you might say. Anyway, it's a myth that somehow the Amazon jungle, but probably every school kid on the planet would repeat that because they read it in a textbook. It's just not true. When you burn gasoline, when you breathe in oxygen, the 7 billion people on the planet right now, That oxygen then is converted to carbon dioxide. That's what you breathe out. And there's not enough plants, or if the best example is go up to, say, Northern Europe, Russia, northern states in the United States, China, or any of the, go across northern India, and through the winter months, see, now if you go to the southern hemisphere, there's not much land there. It's mainly ocean. So you're just dealing with ocean. But in the land part, where the majority of the population of the world lives in the northern hemisphere, and they're all breathing oxygen and exhaling CO2, in the wintertime, there's no trees around to convert the CO2 back to oxygen. So we're literally using up the oxygen that's in the Earth's atmosphere. But there's a lot of it. It's not going to go away tomorrow. But there's some fun facts. People are actually making estimates now. And the estimate is that in the 1800s, there was about 24% of the atmosphere was oxygen. Of course, a high percentage of that is nitrogen. And then a little teeny, teeny, teeny bit is CO2. And that's one of the myths of CO2. But I'm not going to get into that tonight. I'm just going to talk about oxygen. And the issue that today there is only about 21% or 20%. The estimates vary. But we're talking about 3% of the atmospheric oxygen being consumed over the past literally about 120 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And of course, it started out slow, but they burned a lot of very highly polluting fuel back in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, the coal and a lot of the lung illnesses that occurred, etc., because of the just no standards at all for burning and creating energy. That's when energy became a product. It became a worldwide commodity, and the very wealthiest people moved in to take over the energy industry because they knew that the future was in energy. And of course, now they understand that the future is with water, and that's why you're seeing all the conflagrations relative to water in the world today. But the question is, how do you get back 3-4% of the atmosphere of the world in terms of oxygen? How do you do that? What process could you use that would recycle CO2 and get you back to oxygen? Anyway, I'm not going to try and answer that question now. I'm just posing the situation. And finally, people are waking up to the idea that, yes, we are burning oxygen, and that is a critical issue. Probably a lot more important than creating CO2. These are important issues. And anyway, I'm not going to try and answer the question, how are you going to convert that CO2 back into O2? Because there's ongoing work dealing with that very issue. Very interesting problem and very interesting solutions. So anyway, I'll keep you posted on that particular topic. By the way, my main science topic in a little bit here, I'm going to be talking about what it will be like to go into outer space in a space hotel, which is in low Earth orbit. That's my main science topic. But leading into that, just a quick note on alkalinity in water. I've had some questions come in, is alkaline water bad for you? And alkaline water is, or what you'd call hard water, mineralized water that comes in through your natural water sources. It might come from runoff, where you get a lot of mineralization in the water, or it might come from deep wells, also where you get a lot of minerals. But mineralized water is not harmful. It's not bad for you. It just, makes marks on your sink and on the shower wall, and it's hard to get off. And it's very difficult to make soap suds with alkaline water, with hard water. But it's not bad for you. In fact, you really need alkalinity in your water. And normal is about 7.2. But some water, if you have hard water with calcium, magnesium, and iron, etc., you can have an alkalinity of, say, 8.5 or something like that. It's not harmful. And to get that out of your water, you would need a water softener. And so over the last number of weeks, I've given some webinars, some information and talking, and then got feedback from people. And the most common thing I find, the most common misconception, is that people are out there, they're actually looking for solutions to get a whole house solution for their water filter, but they're being sold a water softener. Everybody is out there selling water softeners. I'm the only person that's really selling a water filter and have the capacity to fill the volumes of orders that are going to be generated as people find out about PFAS chemicals, chloramine, glyphosate, etc. And by the way, if you go to my sales page for JMCC water filters, I have a free 10-page pamphlet. I encourage you to download that and read it. And once again, just go to my webpage. There's two webpages I'll give out, jmccsci.com. And if you go there, that's my main J. McCanny Science homepage. Click on JMCC water filters, and that'll take you to the JMCC water filters page. Or you can go directly there by going to jmccwaterfilters.com. And if you scroll down, you'll find there's a place you can put in your email address, and it'll email you the pamphlet, the 10-page pamphlet. But anyway, water softeners are not water filters. Let me explain. Most of the water filters today have a fiberglass looking, it's kind of a hard shell casing on it. And it looks like woven fiberglass because that's what it is. It has replaceable resin in it. Resin is like a powder, and the water goes through that, and through an ion exchange process, it extracts the calcium, magnesium, etc. Most water softeners remove things that are not harmful. They're not toxins. Calcium, magnesium are not bad for you. They're not toxins, and that's why my MR5 water filters do not remove it, because they're not toxins. We only target toxins with the MR5 water filters. And so with water softeners, you need a different resin for everything you want to approach. So if you wanted calcium, magnesium, that would be one tank. If you wanted iron, that would be another tank with a different resin in it. If you wanted arsenic, that would be another tank with another resin in it. And you can start to see there are literally hundreds of resins that are used to target different things in the water. You could target PFAS chemicals. That would be another tank. And so what the soft water companies do is they get a couple, two or three tanks at most, and they target a few basic chemicals or whatever, usually not toxins. And then they remove those, and they call it a whole house water filter, and it is not. It doesn't have a screen. Like, for example, my MR5 filters have a 0.1 micron outer shell, and that is a true filter. Then the inside has a medium that removes thousands and thousands of different chemicals, and it's targeted. And so that is a filter, not a water softener. And so in a lot of cases, people will have a water softener, then they will have the water filter. But my point is that there are many unscrupulous companies out there that are selling water softeners and calling them water filters. Don't be fooled. And they'll tell you all the wonderful things in marketing, literature, etc., all the wonderful things that their system takes out. Oh, and if you want this taken out, then you need another tank. Well, most people don't know what's in their water, especially when it comes to chemicals and toxins and the kind of things that cause cancer. And so you don't know. So what these companies do is they give you two or three tanks. They brag about all of the stuff that they take out, but they don't tell you all the stuff that they don't take out. And so a water filter is my MR5 water filters are unique on the market. You're not going to find them anyplace else. And by the way, from people on the inside track that I talked to recently, they say that there is a water crisis coming. It's going to be a planned agenda, just like COVID, just like the Bay of Tonkin, just like Pearl Harbor, just like 9/11. All of these planned events, and that what they're saying is that there's something planned relative to water. And so anyway, I'm not going to go into details because I've heard various things, and I don't predict the future, but it's like my BS meter has been kind of, the needle on my BS meter has been going up on the high end recently on this same topic. And so I'm just going to tell people that I highly recommend that you get a whole house water filter so that you can deal with these issues. And the other thing is that mineral water is actually good for you. There are studies. I used to sell a product called Via Viente, and then they changed the marketing. Somebody bought the company and ruined it, basically, it was my opinion, and messed up the profit margin for all the salespeople. So it basically went the way of the dinosaur. But at any rate, it was invented by a doctor, and he went around the world to see why there were locations where people were living to 100 years old and longer and very healthy. And he found a place down in Ecuador. He found a place in like India up in the mountains. And what he realized is that they simply had very good mineralized water, a very good balance. So he studied the water, and he produced this product which had berries and other things in it. But the key component was mineralized water. And I'll tell you a little story about myself. I was very unhealthy. If you look at me when I was back in the, maybe in the 90s or in the early 2000s, and I was going around giving a lot of public talks, I was overweight. I had a lot of hair missing on the top of my head and things like that. And then I got healthy. And I'm not going to go through all of the details about how I did that, but one of the things I did was drink mineralized water. And it was not just your average mineralized water. It was but very natural, not something I blended or made myself. But at any rate, what happened is I started losing weight. The hair grew back on the top of my head. My gray hairs went away, and all of a sudden my hair started regaining its natural color because of good mineralized water. So you don't want to drink, you do not want to drink demineralized water in whatever form. That would be reverse osmosis. You do not want to use reverse osmosis as a water filter and then drink that water. You have to remineralize it. There's other like evaporation or other methods of creating distilled water. You do not want to drink distilled water. People think, well, that's the purest form of water. It's really not. Because anything with a lower boiling point than water is going to be in your water with distillation. Distillation is not the magic wand that people think it is. Okay, so anyway, here's an interesting fun fact, that with all the heat on the West Coast right now, the tremendous, you know, heat wave and all of that, what do you think should really happen if there's a tremendous heat wave? Well, it's called evaporation of water because this is out over the ocean also. It's not just over California and the West Coast. This heat wave is out over the ocean. If you have 116 degree temperatures over the Pacific Ocean, it's going to evaporate a lot of water and create rain. So my question is to the people managing this tremendous destructive heat wave, explain to me why there's no evaporation of water on the ocean bringing in vast amounts of rain. And that's the hydrological cycle of the Earth. It's a naturally self-correcting system in which that if it gets too hot, that evaporates the water from the ocean, the water comes in, it rains and cools things down. But it's not happening. Why is there no evaporation of water and rain with these tremendous heat waves over the west coast of the United States. So answer me that one, please. Okay, on to the final story here I'm dealing with. I'm going to start by talking about Richard Branson going into outer space, and that was a few weeks ago, and I just found that absolutely incredible. But the kickback here was that there's a lot of sour grapes. And CNN, here's the title. Listen to this. Richard Branson's Disappointing Space Jaunt. That's a CNN headline. I go to CNN not for news, but to see what kind of garbage they're trying to pawn off on the public. Here's another CNN title. Space Flight A Waste. And they're trying to quote, oh, here's how much carbon was used in the flight. Well, the carbon that was used went up as gases, and it went up in the atmosphere. It's not going to affect anything down here on the good old troposphere. But be that as it may, they're just throwing darts. They're trying to throw mud at the wall and hope some sticks. And then they criticized Jeff Bezos, who had his flight on the 20th of July. I think it was the 20th, a couple days ago. And they went up into space and floated around and threw little ping pong balls at each other and then came back down and landed. And that was their day in space. And then Elon Musk apparently is getting ready to launch people to go into orbit, which is a whole different ballgame. That's something that requires a lot more advanced technology. So Musk, in terms of he didn't get there first, but he's going to be the person who will do the most, let's put it that way. But anyway, what is with these people in CNN? What's the sour grapes about? What's the negativity about? It looks like somebody got their nerves pinched, and I would suspect it's NASA, of course, but who controls NASA? It is... who controls NASA is the CIA. The CIA has been in charge of NASA since 1991 when Robert Harrington discovered Hale-Bopp coming in from the southern part of the solar system. The CIA took over NASA. And Golden came in as the head of NASA, put the lid on it. I saw all this happening in real time, and it took me a number of years to figure out why. It's because Harrington had discovered Planet X, coming into the solar system on a near collision course with Earth. And of course, if you want to know the full story on that, I have a book out that is called Planet X 2020, The Real History of Planet X. That's where I talk about all of those details. But be that as it may, NASA is run by the CIA, and it's a front agency. NASA is never a straight answer, but NASA's whole goal is to cause a lot of fanfare, spend a lot of money, and not go into space, and certainly not to take you into space. You know, they want to go to the back to Mars in 20 years and put somebody, three men on Mars that they can fake in a studio. That's what NASA's space program is all about. So they don't want, the thing they really don't want is some rich guy, Richard Branson or Bezos, whoever, to spend their own money to go up into space and bring people, like regular people. So what's interesting is when you look at Branson and then Bezos, they did not have space suits. They didn't have helmets. They didn't have special gear. They didn't have gloves that had, you know, big fat fingers, and they didn't have space packs. They were just dressed in kind of like a little space jumpsuit. Something you would have seen on Star Trek, you know, like Spock would have been wearing a little, you know, spaceman jumpsuit in the Enterprise, or Scotty or Captain Kirk, whatever. They did not have space suits with helmets and stuff, and so neither did these modern astronauts who are now spacefaring, going up into space and coming back down. And so what is all the criticism about? What's all the sour grapes? What's all of the throwing darts at them about, trying to pick apart anything that will, affect the, basically they were trying to affect the woke community and say, oh, there was carbon, not carbon neutral. They spent all of this. And of course, Bezos was using hydrogen, which is not carbon it is not carbon-based at all. So anyway, they had to throw darts at him for not being carbon neutral, and oh my goodness, sour grapes all over the place. But anyway, I just found it bizarre that CNN and I was on John Moore's show a couple weeks ago, and some yo-yo calls in and he starts real aggressive and at me about saying, well, it's all fake, everything in space is fake and going on. And I told the station, hang up on this joker. I don't even want to talk to him, let alone bring up all these topics. And trying to criticize Branson and saying, oh, well, he didn't really, it was all faked. And it was like, no, buddy, go back to your internet feed and, you know, to grandma's basement and sit there and look at your computer screen, please. But don't bother me. But anyway, what I want to talk about today is something on a positive note. What is it going to be like? And you're going to, I mean, probably you look at your kids, they're going to be going into space. Some of you may not, but if some of you have some interest, you probably will be going into space. I myself have a little space program. It's called the Space Hotel Launch System. It's JMCC, which is my trade name. Some of it is trademarked. JMCC Wing is trademarked now. It's registered, bona fide registered trademark. And so the JMCC Wing Generator and JMCC Wing is the company, the parent company, JMCC Wing LLC. It's a registered trademark. Okay, so anyway, just another comment about Branson. Here's a guy who took his money. He had a dream to go into space, took his money, and through a lot of difficulty and with people pushing hard against him, trying to prevent him from going into space. When they first won the Ansari X Prize, they were in the process of doing this, and all of a sudden the FAA comes in and goes, well, we're going to make all kinds of regulations because it's for the safety of the people. And I, at the time, I made a public announcement. I said, well, this is pretty bizarre. You know, there's no regulation about, say, surfboards. You know, here you got people, you buy a surfboard for a couple hundred bucks and you can go out in the waves, and that if you can crack your head open on the surf or being pounded on a wave into a rock or something, the FAA is not interested there. You got kids skateboarding down city streets, hills in the hills of California, going like crazy. Nobody's regulating that. Nobody cares about them busting their heads open. You know, I mean, for the safety of these very few people who are exploring space, all of a sudden we got to have all these rules and regulations for the safety. And because NASA can't do it, they killed a bunch of people, by not even having a parachute handy for them. Anyway, that's another story. But the reality is that going into space is very easy. Now, look at the liftoff and everything for Branson's flight. They went up in an airplane. It's just like getting in an airplane and, you know, going up into a jet airplane up to 45,000 feet. No big deal. No tremendous torques, you know, no space suit, no space helmets. And, you know, just a nice, what would you call it, a buckle. A seat belt to hold them in place, shoulder strap seat belt. And then when they get dropped off from the carrier vehicle, they go down and the acceleration into space is no big deal. It's acceleration. It'd be like it's the equivalent of you stepping on the gas pedal hard in your car. It wouldn't be any more strenuous than that. And then when they get up, they finally, the people were talking about what it was like when the engine finally cut out, accelerating, and all of a sudden they're weightless. Boom, there you are, weightless. But there was no big transition like hitting a sound barrier or something like that. But if you go into space, now I'm going to take you a step further. Someday there will be a space hotel up there, and there will be if I have anything to do with it myself. And as far as I can tell you, I am going to go do that. I'm going to build space hotels, and it'll get funded, and there are already people doing that. I just have a particular business model and a particular business as far as the physical plans. I have a physical plan, but they'll be there. Whether it's me or someone else, there will be space hotels. And when you go to them, it'll be just like flying from here to London. You go up in about probably even less time if you're flying, you know, from, let's say, from Fort Lauderdale to Dallas. It'd be about the same thing, couple-hour flight. You know, if you get up there, get up into orbit, approach the space station, hook up with it, the airlock. You know, you get out, you walk through the airlock. And this will be a rotating space station with artificial gravity equal to Earth. So when you get there, you'll have gravity. You won't be weightless. You might have some weightlessness in the interim for a period of time. And by the way, that's one of the interesting things, too, I noticed about both the Branson and the Bezos launches. Nobody vomited, you know. That's a typical thing. When you first go up into space and you're floating around and you get, you know, I'd probably lose my cookies myself. I'm kind of wheezy with stuff like that or various other things. And so I would probably throw up myself. But none of these people did. And so they were floating around for quite a bit of time. You know, I don't know how many seconds or minutes or whatever. And then when they came back down, it was a very gentle reentry. It wasn't like the space shuttle where, you know, you have the space shuttle is called the flying brick because it's so massive. When it comes in, it takes all of this heat energy to slow it down. Branson's spacecraft, and the same with Bezos, was very lightweight and so and very airy, etc. And so when you go up to the space hotel, it'll be just like walking into any hotel. You'll have artificial gravity. You'll have nice restaurants. You'll have swimming pools. You'll have spas and saunas and, you know, a relaxing weekend. Or, say, a week, there'll be people honeymooning in space. They'll go up to space for their honeymoon and come back as an experience for you know, but it'll be with gravitational field, etc. And there will be manufacturers that go up there. There might be conferences that are held. Now, a space station, the ones that I had designed, had a room for around 16,000 people in a space hotel. So that's the type of thing that'll be going on. And it looks like I got about a half a minute left on my show here. So I just want to remind you, go back to the webpage, jmccsci.com, or the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com, plural. And the sale is still on. The sale will be on for about another day. It's 10% sale. And anyway, go there and get yourself a whole house water filter, something you really are going to need. You need it already. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.